5 hours Universal Time. Stay tuned for Daybreak Africa coming up after these latest world news headlines.
I'm Steve Norman reporting. An explosion in the German city of Ansbach near Nuremberg has killed a suspected bomber and injured 10 other people. It was the fourth violent incident in Germany in a week and came as the country is still on the edge after the killing of 9 people by an 18-year-old gunman in Munich on Friday. Deakin University terrorism expert Greg Barton speaks with VOA about how these kinds of attacks can be prevented.
Germany, of course, is asking itself what it should do about its gun laws. This teenager purchased his Glock pistol, through the dark web, through that hidden section of the internet used for criminal transactions. But police are trying to see whether that could be helped. I think the more obvious line of inquiry is to see what could be done with mental health interventions, and that's a struggle in every country. No country gets this completely right.
German investigators say the teenage gunman in Munich received psychiatric treatment and planned the mass shooting for more than a year. A militant group that has waged war against the Nigerian government over the country's vital oil sector said it is holding talks with Abuja on ending a wave of attacks on oil and gas facilities in the Niger Delta. The Movement for the Emancipation of the Niger Delta, or MEND, said Sunday it is preliminary talks aimed at finding solutions on the future of the region. Men signed a 2009 amnesty agreement with the government in exchange for cash as well as job training. But another group, the Niger Delta Avengers, responsible for recent attacks, said it is not part of the dialogue. Militants have been demanding a greater share of the oil wealth from the impoverished Niger Delta region. This is VOA News. Members of Turkey's ruling and main opposition parties came together in a rally in support of democracy and to condemn the bloody coup attempt on July 15th. The rally, held under tight supervision Sunday in Istanbul's iconic Taksim Square, was called for by Turkey's largest opposition group, the Secular Republican People's Party. They were joined by other opposition parties and President Recep Tayyip Erdogan's Islamic Justice and Conservative Party, the AKP, which has ruled Turkey since 2002. President Erdogan, who escaped capture and possible death in the attempted coup, has declared a state of emergency that enables him to sign laws to help identify supporters of the failed coup, during which at least 246 people were killed and more than 2,000 injured. Turkish authorities have investigated, detained, or suspended more than 60,000 civil servants, judges, police, soldiers, and teachers in the past week on suspicion of being associated with the coup attempt. The International Olympic Committee has decided against banning all Russian teams from competing in next month's Olympic Games over allegations of an elaborate doping scheme. IOC President Thomas Bach.
The international sports federations will carry out an individual analysis of each athlete's anti-doping record, taking into account only reliable international tests. That means Russian tests cannot be taken into consideration.
And in Moscow on Sunday, Russian sports minister Vitaly Mutko voiced relief that the IOC did not impose a countrywide ban. This year's Summer Olympics will be held in Rio de Janeiro starting August 5th. VOA will have complete coverage. British cyclist Chris Froome successfully defended his Tour de France title on Sunday and has now won the multi-stage race 3 times in the past 4 years. Fleur Howard Griffin and her husband watched Froome come across the finishing line on Paris's Champs-Élysées.
A machine. Yeah, well, he's won most of the stages, I think, so far. I was here when he won last year as well, so I think you could say he's a machine. He's almost like Lance Armstrong, but without the drugs.
Kenyan Barn Froome held a lead for more than 4 minutes over Frenchman Romain Bardet heading into the 21st and final, largely ceremonial stage in Paris. Get more news at our website, voanews.com.
That's the latest world news from VOA.
Good morning, Africa. Welcome to Daybreak Africa from the Voice of America. I'm James Bate in Washington. Today is Monday, July 25th, and here are some of the stories we are covering. A senior African Union official says the Rwanda summit was an overwhelming success.
The summit also issued symbolically, but also practically, an African Union passport. And so the summit was not just a success, but a really a resounding success.
Erastu Muecha is the deputy chair of the African Union Commission. Meanwhile, Burundi is alleging that it did not attend the summit because the African Union could not guarantee the security of its delegation. Nearly 3,000 migrants have died so far this year crossing the Mediterranean Sea. And Liberia celebrates 169th independence anniversary tomorrow, Tuesday.
This year, we are celebrating our anniversary with a team of consolidating the progress towards transformation of Liberia.
Jeremiah Solonte is Liberia's ambassador to the United States. We'll hear the views of two Liberians about the independence anniversary in the context of next year's presidential election. Senegal's government clamps down on street beggars, and a study says chicken odor repels mosquitoes that carry malaria. Those stories, plus our listener of the day, are coming up on Daybreak Africa. The African Union summit that concluded last week in Rwanda was an overwhelming success, says the deputy chair of the African Union Commission. Erastu Muecha says the summit not only issued an African Union passport, but also it took pride in many member states meeting some of the AU's gender-related goals, including health education, employment, and social welfare. Muecha also said he had no knowledge of Burundi's claim that it did not attend the summit because the African Union could not guarantee the security of its delegation.
It was a resounding success. In fact, it was an unprecedented success because, as you know, that this is a summit that talks about the rest of the deal for the African Union, and that is integration. It looked at the issues of the setting up of the continental free trade area. The summit looked at how to finance integration. In fact, that was a major decision, something that has been on the table for some time now and was resolved. The summit also issued symbolically, but also practically, an African Union passport. And so the summit was not just a success, but a really a resounding success.
There are those who say that the situation in South Sudan might have hijacked the summit and its main theme.
Not at all. It was discussed within the normal time and context that normally it would have been discussed. And so there was nothing like hijacking. Of course, the summit was concerned at the grave situation in South Sudan, but I won't go to the extent of saying that it hijacked the summit.
The African Union did not choose a new chairperson of the commission, and you also being the deputy chair. That election probably is being moved to the next summit. Was it a good thing that this happened? Or because some people are crediting the involvement of Africans themselves for making sure that the right people are elected.
The requirement for election to occupy a position of commission in the African Union requires that one is elected with a two-thirds majority, and that is a very high threshold. There was elections, and of the three candidates, none of them was able to secure a two-thirds. And according to the rules, when such a situation develops, you suspend elections and hold another election in 6 months. 6 months because that is what it takes now to call for new candidatures, do the necessary preparations, and that's when the next summit will take place, and that's when the next election will take place.
The Burundian foreign minister is saying that his country did not attend the recent African Union summit because it did not get security guarantee for its delegation from the African Union.
I'm just hearing that for the first time, and I don't know what it means by security guarantee in this case, because when a country is host to AU meeting, there is a memorandum of understanding, there is a host agreement that is signed, and that host agreement, among other things, provides for security and self-passage of all the delegates that are coming to attend the meeting. And as far as we're concerned, that was signed with Rwanda, and I don't remember any time that there was any information given to us of security gaps or lapses or breaches. So I cannot comment on something that I'm just hearing from the press.
Did the African Union know that Burundi did not attend the Rwanda summit?
I saw the delegation of Burundi at the start of the meeting, and that was the meeting of permanent representatives. Thereafter, I didn't see the delegation at the ministerial and heads of state government level, and there was no communication as to why that was the case.
So the political situation in Burundi, was it addressed at the Kigali summit?
It was addressed because peace and security item was on the agenda, and there was a general review of peace and security in the continent and those particular areas, including Burundi.
Erastus Mwecha is the deputy chair of the African Union Commission. He was speaking with me from Kenya's capital, Nairobi. After failing to attend the African Union summit in Rwanda last week, Burundi has blamed the African Union for not guaranteeing the security of its delegation. Moses Javier Rimana reports from Bujumbura.
As the 27th African Union summit ended in Rwanda's capital on Monday, not all member states participated in the summit. And this time, Burundi, whose relation with Rwanda that hosted the summit continued to deteriorate since last year. Burundi's Foreign Affairs Minister, Alain Nyamitwe, said that the African Union wasn't able to guarantee the security of the Burundian delegates.
When a country hosts such multilateral conference, knowing that they have problems with a particular member state, they need to give more attention to that state. Like I said, the fact that our permanent representative participated in the meeting of ambassadors does not mean that the security was okay. It simply shows the good faith of our government.
Rwanda had accused Burundi of sheltering FDLR rebels. Kigali have accused the rebel group of committing the 1994 genocide against the Tutsi. And in contrary, Bujumbura and the United Nations said that the Rwandan government played a part in destabilizing Burundi and continued to militarily train Burundi refugees in efforts to oust President Pierre Nkurunziza.
We hope that the message was well received, that with our non-participation in the sessions of the Executive Council and then of the summit itself, that the AU has realized that indeed there is a serious problem between Burundi and Rwanda. And because of that, we hope to get in touch very soon, hopefully, with the Commission on the way to address this issue.
As the political crisis that have hit Burundi for almost a year now, the Rwanda-Burundi deteriorating relation is yet to be addressed by the regional or continental bodies. The Burundian government had called on the African Union to find a mechanism of settling the disputes between the two neighboring countries. As the efforts are made to defuse the political crisis in the country, the inter-Burundi dialogue under the facilitation of the former Tanzanian President Benjamin Mkapa ended in a mayhem last week, with the government refusing to sit together with some opposition leaders who it accuses of plotting a failed coup last year. More than 500 people have been killed and 1,000 have been displaced since the political crisis began in April last year. Moses Havyarimana, VOA Africa, Bujumbura.
Liberia celebrates 169 years of independence tomorrow, Tuesday. Liberia's ambassador to the United States, Jeremiah Solonte, says while there are some challenges, the country has made tremendous progress under President Ellen Johnson Sirleaf.
This year, we are celebrating our anniversary with a theme of consolidating the progress towards transformation of Liberia. As you know, the Agenda 2030 that has been encouraged by our president, Madam Ellen Johnson Sirleaf, is a long-range plan. And so every progress we are making towards the transformation of Liberia needs to be celebrated. So this year, the team is to be able to consolidate the progress we made thus far, even though there are still challenges, but towards the transformation of our
country. I just come back from Liberia, and people on the ground were saying, economically, there are some things that are not going well.
Oh, definitely. We are also aware of the challenges that still lie ahead of us. But you can agree with me that under Madam Sirleaf, there have been tremendous progress made in harnessing our effort to rehabilitate some of the infrastructure that were broken as a result of the Civil War. We have the electricity. The Mankofi Hydro Project is coming live, hopefully in December. We had several miles of roads that have been paved that were never touched during the last 20, 30 years. So there are a lot of progress being made, but at the same time, we still have challenges.
You have been ambassador to the United States now, if I'm not mistaken, 4 years now?
Yes, 4 years.
I hear that this might be your last year. What are your plans?
Well, James, you know, even though the diplomatic position is not a tenure position, but usually diplomats are posted for 4 years. But of course, as, at the same time, you serve at the will and pleasure of the president. So we counting on that, calculating, assuming that we'll be here for 4 years. This should be my last independence celebration, and we look forward to serving the Liberian people in other capacities that may come by.
Mr. Ambassador, next year is a presidential election in Liberia. There have been rumors that perhaps you might be considering to run for president.
Well, James, we have been part of the political process for the last little over 10 years. So there are great opportunities that we can also be part of 2017. I'm not really sure at what level yet, but I can see safely that 2017 will be part of the process.
And just along those lines, there have also been rumors that you are being courted by either the vice president or other people to be their vice presidential running mate?
The truth of the matter is many of the presidential candidates are talking, I mean, and not only to me. I know everyone is talking to someone. So people have been talking. People have been asking us for what role we'd like to play in their own camp. But the bigger picture is for Liberia.
Jeremiah Salonte is Liberia's ambassador to the United States. He spoke with me ahead of Liberia's 169th independence anniversary tomorrow, Tuesday. This past Saturday, Liberians gathered on the grounds of their country's embassy in Washington, D.C. for a pre-Independence Day celebration. I asked some of them about the importance of the day and why Liberians should be celebrating. The discussion of the first two persons I spoke with took on a tone that is symbolic of the political climate in Liberia at this time, especially as the country prepares for presidential election next year. The two are Lahai Swari, who identifies himself as the vice chair of the Patriot Movement, a group that wants to elect Vice President Joseph Boakai to succeed President Ellen Johnson Sirleaf. I also spoke with Liberian journalist Jerry Wayan.
My name is Lahai Swari from Baltimore, Maryland. I'm currently the vice chairperson for the DMV area when it comes to the Patriots Movement for electing the Honorable Boakai as President of the Republic of Liberia. I'm excited to be here to celebrate our country's independence today. Most importantly, today for me being here is also to mobilize our Liberian youth and our Liberian public to tell them more about Honorable Joseph Boakai as the standard bearer for the Unity Party. Economically, I will tell you this, the country right now where we are, I would say that the Honorable Boakai has a solution to take us to the next level economically.
I do thank you very much.
Yeah, James, I'm Jerry Weir, a former broadcaster at ELWA, ELBC, Executive Mansion TV commentator to President Talbert. We have nothing to celebrate. The United Nations has just turned over peacekeeping or national security to the government of Liberia as of July 1st. The army, the police, the immigration, healthcare workers at President Ellen Johnson's hometown in Bombing, Tubman, they have not been paid for 3 months. What is there to celebrate? Yesterday, the Minister of State for Presidential Affairs, Edward McLean, died in a hospital in South Africa. The former Associate Justice of the Supreme Court, Emmanuel Warren, died in Ghana. Another former government official, Willie Knuckles, died in Ghana. They didn't die at JFK. Why are they not going to JFK instead of going to foreign countries? Because the government has neglected the healthcare system in Liberia. The president himself, Ellen Johnson Sirleaf, travels to the United States every year for the best in healthcare paid for with our tax dollars. The rate of exchange, the American dollar, is now scarce in Liberia. It is now 100 in some places, 100 Liberian dollars to one U.S. dollar. Business owners are refusing the Liberian dollar because they cannot buy their goods outside Liberia with the worthless Liberian currency. What is there to celebrate? Nothing except that we don't have war.
Thank you very much. I guess you disagree.
Well, I disagree in the sense that Madam Ellen Johnson Sirleaf, there are developments the country so far that she's done that we can highlight a whole lot, though she has shortcomings. And the Honorable Joseph Boakai, he's not Madam Ellen Johnson Sirleaf, and he has a very good platform for Republic of Liberia. Now, with whatever the brother just talked about, Honorable Joseph Buga has nothing to do with all of that. What we're talking about is the future of Liberia today.
Jerry, I give you the last word.
I don't have anything personally against Mr. Buga, but he is the number one advisor to President Ellen Johnson Sirleaf. If this was in the United States, if Joe Biden was running for president, they would attack him on the record of him as vice president to Barack Obama. Joseph Buga bears the responsibility. He's running on the record of Ellen Johnson Sirleaf. So there's no way he can excuse himself from the failure of the Ellen Johnson Sirleaf.
Let me say happy 26th to you.
That was journalist Jerry Wayne, and you also heard Lahai Sware, who calls himself vice president for the Patriot Movement, a group that wants to elect Vice President Joseph Boakai to succeed President Ellen Johnson Sirleaf. You're listening to Daybreak Africa on the Voices of America, and today is July 25th. And I'm James Butte in Washington. The International Organization for Migration reports nearly 3,000 refugees and migrants crossing the Mediterranean Sea to Europe have died so far this year. Most of these deaths have occurred along the dangerous route from North Africa to Italy. Lisa Schlein reports for VOA from IOM headquarters in Geneva.
This is the earliest that reported deaths on the Mediterranean have reached 3,000 since the migration crisis hit Europe 4 years ago. In 2014, reported fatalities reached the 3,000-person mark in September. Last year, it was in October. IOM spokesman Joel Millman says having such a large number of migrants perish before the end of July this year is alarming.
It's also very important to note that we are approaching the 250,000 arrival mark. Last year, we didn't hit 3,000 until almost 1 million people had come. So to have 3,000 with a quarter of that number is an indicator of just how lethal this passage has been.
Millman says refugees and migrant flows from Turkey to Greece have almost disappeared. So he notes most of the sea traffic and fatalities are now occurring among sub-Saharan Africans, making the perilous journey from North Africa to Italy. He tells VOA about 20 migrants are dying every day in the Mediterranean Sea. He says IOM staff is talking to the Libyan Coast Guard about the dangers facing people who board smugglers' boats.
The Coast Guard has had some luck turning back voyages from Libya. We've heard in the last 6 weeks a number of cases where they've been able to turn boats back. They're also recovering bodies at an alarming rate as well. So we have mixed feelings about calling that a success.
IOM runs an assisted voluntary return and reintegration program for migrants in Libya. Millman says the agency has succeeded in repatriating thousands of stranded migrants to their homes in sub-Saharan Africa. Lisa Schlein for VOA News, Geneva.
Authorities in Senegal have clamped down on begging in a bid to cleanse the capital, Dakar, and other major urban centers of beggars. The government says the campaign is necessary to protect underaged children from the daily financial exploitation by local Quranic teachers who use the young people as a source of revenue. Alpha Jallo reports.
Since the operation began 2 weeks ago, more than 200 beggars, mainly young boys known as talibs, attending the traditional Quranic school called Daras, are currently being sheltered into various orphanage centers in Dakar and other big towns across Senegal. The government spokesperson Seydou Gueye said during a televised speech that the objective of the new measure is not aimed in fighting the traditional Quranic schools, but to give more protection and care to such vulnerable children. However, human rights defenders in Senegal hailed the operation as long overdue, citing the high number of risks involved in begging, especially in big cities like Dakar. Jibril Balde is the West Africa focal person for International Refugee Rights Initiative.
As a human rights defender, we really appreciate the measure that the Senegalese authorities has taken to ban child begging in the streets of Dakar and all the Senegalese administrative regions. Because we really think that the place of children is not the streets. Children need to be in schools. Children need to be definitely protected.
The human rights defender further stresses the need by the government to adopt new laws aimed at punishing parents and chronic teachers who are in the habit of sending these young kids into the street to beg.
We also think that the government should go further by, you know, adopting new laws, which definitely will seriously punish parents who will definitely dare send their kids to the streets in order to beg. So all these decisions definitely have to be supported because we really need to protect these kids.
So far, there are mixed reactions from ordinary Senegalese about this new measure. While most of them hail it as a positive development, others oppose it on the grounds that begging, almsgiving, and charity is part and parcel of the cultural and traditional norms of the society. Cherno Cisse, a university student, argues that in as much as beggars accept almsgiving, ordinary Senegalese also have the habit of giving out alms and making charities.
We all condemn sending these little boys to the streets to beg, but Senegalese society is so complex that there are times when we also need to give out alms and charity to beggars. I think the best thing is for the government to organize them in such a way that people can take alms or charity to them.
But the government says that it will not back out from this measure of cleansing the street of Dakar and environs free from beggars. Alpha Diallo for VOA Daybreak Africa, Dakar.
If you live in Africa, in a malaria endemic area, it might not be such a crazy idea to sleep with a chicken. It turns out some mosquitoes are repelled by the odor of chickens, potentially offering another cheap protection method against the mosquito-borne illness, views Jessica Berman reports.
Most mosquitoes, including those that carry the often deadly malaria parasite, like to bite humans. They transmit the disease through a blood meal. They also take blood meals occasionally from cattle, goats, and sheep. But the insects are selective feeders. Mosquitoes do not like the taste of chicken blood, so poultry rarely gets bitten. Swedish researchers made the discovery in field studies in Ethiopia. They set up traps to capture the most common mosquito in the area, Anopheles arabiensis, in 11 houses in Addis Ababa. Investigators then tested the blood inside the mosquitoes, finding blood from all sorts of animals, but rarely chickens. That begs the question, should people in malaria-endemic regions sleep next to a chicken? It's a joke that Rickard Ignell hears all the time.
Oh, yeah. We do that all the time. And we have the joke also that people should carry a chicken around to protect themselves against malaria, but hasn't really caught on yet.
Ignell is a professor at the Swedish University of Agricultural Sciences and studies the chemical attraction of disease-carrying insects. For the study, Ignell recruited volunteers to sleep under untreated bed nets with traps baited with chicken compounds nearby.
That was VOA's Jessica Berman reporting. That's it for this Monday, July 25th edition of Daybreak Africa. We thank you for starting this week with us. On behalf of the Daybreak Africa crew, producer Nicole Beckford, reporters Peter Clotty and Ricky Stryak, along with all of our engineers, I'm James Butte in Washington, wishing all of you in Africa a very productive week.
Next time on Street Talk Africa, Shaka Sali and his guests will discuss the Democratic National Convention and what a Hillary Clinton presidency could mean for Africa. Tune in to Straight Talk Africa next Wednesday at 18:30 UTC, right here on VOA Africa. Next on Let's Talk, Men in Relationships. What should they do to keep them going and flourish? Join hosts Sunday Shomari and his guests discussing men in relationships. This lighthearted show covers topics of your interest. Let's Talk comes to you Mondays at 17:30 UTC, right here on VOA Africa.